The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily this Friday, June 10th. We're coming to you from Jerusalem, Israel today. I'm Brent Noctegal, filling in for Mr. Stephen Flurry. As you might have heard, Israel is currently under a heightened security alert over this upcoming weekend of the holiday of Shavuot, or the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, as we call it. And most of this security alert was prompted by Wednesday night's killing of four Israelis by two Palestinian terrorists. And at the start of the program, I'd just like to discuss what happened on Wednesday night, just a couple of days into the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. And to do that, I'll quote from a Times of Israel article. It's titled, "In Suits and Ties, Gunmen Shatter Israelis' Hope. Terror Wave Has Ended." And it's by Judah Ari Gross. This is what he writes. In just a few minutes, two 21-year-old terrorists shattered the calm that Israelis were cautiously starting to enjoy over a half a year of regular terrorist attacks. A little after 9 p.m., two men, cousins according to police, brothers according to Palestinian media reports, were seated at an outdoor table in Max Brenner's, a fashionable international restaurant chain known for its rich chocolate desserts in Tel Aviv's upscale Sirona market. The young Palestinian men wore black suits, white shirts, and black ties. They looked like, quote, lawyers, Yosef Jarabin, a bartender at the restaurant, told journalists after the attack. The two men, named in Palestinian media as Mohammed and Khalid Mahmoura, ordered milky fudge brownies, the Max Brenner bartender said. The decadent dessert is made of milk chocolate truffle cream fudge brownies, white chocolate pieces, and whipped cream, and is served with a hot fudge sauce. But the terrorists never ate their milky fudge brownies, Jabirin said. They left it on the table for a few minutes, and then they started shooting. Approximately 15 minutes after they walked in, the two men took out Carl Gustav style machine guns and indiscriminately opened fire at the restaurant's patrons. At least four people were killed in the terror attack and many more were injured to varying degrees, including three in serious condition and two who were lightly wounded. And then the article says, a number of questions still linger about the terror attack, as the terrorists did not have valid work permits. How did they enter Israel from the West Bank? Was the attack directed by a terror group? And so on. And then it says, and most importantly, is this the beginning of a bloody Ramadan? So as I said earlier, Ramadan began on Tuesday, and this is the holy month for the Muslims, where they fast during the daylight portions of the day, and they spend a lot of time at the mosques, and which in Jerusalem can lead to a lot more violence, and potentially that is what we're looking at for this upcoming month. Now, in the aftermath of the attack, thousands of border police, and volunteers, officers, they began patrolling the narrow and winding alleyways of the old city, even as we speak today, and they started looking after more intently the East Jerusalem Arab areas. And police, they, although it hasn't seemed like it's happened yet today, they are aware that after Friday prayers, they might have some heightened violence around the Al-Aqsa Mosque and through the old city. So there are some actions that Israel's taking after this attack. It looks like from over the last couple of days that they have frozen about 83,000 permits for Palestinians in the West Bank that wanted to visit Israel during Ramadan to visit their relatives. And special Ramadan permits were also suspended for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip that wanted to travel out of the Gaza Strip to attend prayers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Also, the army announced that they were going to deploy two additional battalions comprising hundreds of troops of infantry and special forces units to the West Bank. And then the Israeli Defense Forces said late yesterday that they were going to seal off the West Bank and the Gaza Strip entirely for the Pentecost holiday. And that is going to, that's already in effect, and it's going to last till Sunday night when Pentecost ends. Of course, if there is need, medical or humanitarian need, then there will be travel allowed from the West Bank to Israel proper. So there are some actions that Israel is taking to try and stop this from happening again, just in case the Palestinians would like to see an uptick in violence through Ramadan, as they are incited more towards violence in this period more than other times of the year. And we'll see how things develop with this, and we're going to keep you posted on thetrumpet.com and through kpcg.fm. Looking forward, maybe next week we'll write an article or two just updating you on this heightened terror alert that exists in Israel. Now, certainly prophetically, as we look at these terrorist attacks, we expect them to ratchet up in the future as time goes forward, that the tension is not going to dissipate. And really, this some are calling it an intifada or an uprising, has been going on for the past 6 months or so, going on to a longer period than that. So we'll see if it continues to develop and if there are more attacks, and we'll keep you posted. Now, earlier in the week, before the terrorist attack, there was concern amongst Israelis that there was going to be more heightened risk of attack in Jerusalem, specifically because of the celebration of Jerusalem Day on Sunday. Jerusalem Day is a celebration of Jerusalem being unified under Israeli rule, which happened during the Six-Day War of 1967. So on Sunday, Jerusalem was flooded with Jews from all over Israel to celebrate this day, which really did unite the nation in no way, or in a way that no event since that's the Six-Day War and the taking of the Old City has happened. Taking back the Old City from the Jordanians at the time was a very emotional event in 1967, and a very spiritual event as well for many. Finally, the Jews could worship where their forefathers had. And really, it was the crowning achievement for the Jews of a miraculous war where everything seemed to go right in Israel's favor. Every commentators looking at this war in 1967 said or say it was the perfect war. At least that's how George Friedman described it earlier this week. We have an article in the Trumpet Weekly that's coming out later on today, and we feature George Friedman's article in there about the Six-Day War. And he says that Israel waged the perfect war. So by all accounts, that celebration of Jerusalem Day on Sunday was recollecting a time 49 years ago where people see or saw Israel's military for the first time as a strong force in the Middle East, one that would be very, very hard to conquer. And for some people, including Israelis, it gave them the sense of invincibility. Now, for many at the time, though, this victory was not one where they patted themselves on the back. This was a victory where they noticed that in all situations and in most areas of the war, they came out on top, even though they didn't have superior numbers, even though at times they were going after goals that they didn't initially plan on going after at the outset of the war, and yet it turned out in victory. Now, we have an article on thetrumpet.com, or at thetrumpet.com, and it's entitled Israel's Military Israel's Miracle Victory, and that's written by David Vigil. You can search for it on the side, or if you're listening to this on SoundCloud, we'll put the link in the notes so you can read this article. And it's a very powerful article because it contrasts what people would say today about Israel's military genius in producing that victory to how it was received at the time. How it was received during the Six-Day War and thereafter by many people, many journalists reporting on it, and even the Israeli leadership, and they saw it as more of a miracle or an act of supernatural help that produced that victory for them. Now, this is how that article begins, and I'm going to quote it a little bit here so you can see just how the odds were not in the favor of the Jews. This article, again, is entitled Israel's Miracle Victory. And this is what David Vigil writes. He says, 131 hours and 50 minutes. That's all it took for the tiny nation of Israel to devastate the armies of Egypt, Jordan, and Syria between June 5th and June 10th, 1967. In just 6 days, Israel changed the course of Middle East history and politics. At the end of one of the shortest wars in history, more than 10,000 Egyptians, 700 Jordanians, and 400 Syrians had died. In addition, more than 20,000 from these three nations were wounded. Israel, on the other hand, claimed fewer than 800 dead, 2,563 wounded. That amounts to Israel killing 25 enemy troops for every one Israeli lost. The prisoner of war rate proved even more lopsided in Israel's favor. Israel captured more than 5,000 Egyptians, of whom 21 were generals, 365 Syrians, and 550 Jordanians. Israel's prisoner of war number totaled just 15. The magnitude, the article continues, of Israel's victory is even clearer in the view of the disparity in material destruction. Israel destroyed 85% of Egypt's military hardware and plundered vast stores of ammunition and tanks. It captured hundreds of both Jordanians and Syria's tanks and thousands of their military vehicles and guns. Israel's attacks on its enemies' air forces were even more thorough. Egypt lost all of its bombers and 85% of its combat aircraft, most on the first day of the war. All of Jordan's airfields and fighters were destroyed in the first day of battle, and Syria's air force was also severely crippled. In all, Israel destroyed more than 400 aircraft while losing only 36 of its 180 planes. Finally, consider how much territory Israel conquered. By the war's end, Israel occupied the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and all of Jerusalem. Israel conquered 42,000 square miles, making the nation three times its original size in 1 week. 40 years ago, Vigil writes, Israel's tenacious military victory astounded the world. How did it happen, he asks? It can only be explained by a miracle. And at the time, as the article goes on to discuss, there are a number of incidences being reported where inexplicable events took place during the war. Events like the Egyptians being ordered to retreat back through the Sinai before a single Israeli was even seen. One Egyptian officer later stated, "I cannot describe to you what we felt during the retreat from Sharm el-Sheikh. We nearly cried, for we could not believe what was happening. We never saw one Israeli soldier." They're retreating without anyone actually coming to them. Another incident, a reserve officer of the Egyptian Armored Brigade witnessing another retreat said, "Everyone lost their heads. The army on the road was in a state of complete collapse. It was a massacre, a disaster. Israel would never have achieved a quarter of its victory if not for the confusion and chaos." Now, when it came to Jerusalem, the Israelis themselves were amazed by the way that things were working out in the Six-Day War. And at the time, they weren't ashamed to admit, or weren't shy to admit, that God was helping them. This is what the commander Raphael Eitan, who led the paratroopers of his 35th Brigade to capture the old city of Jerusalem, said. Quote, "Apparently someone in heaven was watching over us. Every unintended action they took, and every unintended action we took, always turned to our advantage." See, God was working it out that Israel would win the Six-Day War. And what's more, many Israelis acknowledged that fact, that God was behind it, that God did it. Indeed, we know from prophecy that the nation of Israel today, or the biblical tribe of Judah, would have a state. But the everyday Israelis were noticing it, religious or not, that this was an amazing, astounding victory that could not be added up just to military prowess. Now, following his blow-by-blow analysis, the military correspondent for the secular Haaretz newspaper he summed up the Six-Day War account with this admission. Remember, this is a secular paper, and this is a non-religious man. He said, even a non-religious person must admit this war was fought with help from heaven. Now imagine that coming out from Haaretz today. that correspondent would be fired. Fired on the spot for admitting that God was the one that gave the victory in the Six-Day War. Now, the IDF, another anecdote, the IDF Director of Operations, Major General Azir Wiseman, was asked by Mr. Levinon, he was the father of a fallen pilot, how he explains the fact that for three straight hours, Israel's Air Force flew from one Egyptian airstrip to another, destroying the enemy planes, yet the Egyptians did not radio ahead to inform their own forces of the oncoming Israeli attack. So the IDF director was asked, why did they do that? How can you explain that? Now, Wiseman, who later served as the president of the State of Israel, he was silent for a bit, and then he lifted his head and exclaimed, "The finger of God." That from the president of Israel, someone who would later become the president of Israel, acknowledging that it was the finger of God that was blessing the victory in the Six-Day War. Leaders all over Israel at the time, secular and otherwise, recognized that this victory was not just because Israel or Israelis were good fighters. Remember, this was a fledgling nation which by all accounts was far less in number and material than its enemies. Yet Israelis today and spectators commentating today see that victory, looking back 49 years, as being purely the result of intelligence and courage. Yes, you will find some fringe people talking about how God provided a miracle victory for them in the Six-Day War. Yet the thought is not among the common public today that God would actually intervene in world affairs to help them win that victory in the Six-Day War. Friedman, like I said, whose article is in the Trumpet Weekly today, he writes of this victory. He said, "Israel waged the perfect war as much as this is possible. It had superb intelligence, struck with strategic and tactical surprise, rapidly broke the Egyptian command structure, and then systematically secured both the West Bank and the Golan Heights. As important," he goes on to write, "the Israelis established a reputation for military invincibility that remains today." And as he goes on, points out in that article, that thought that they are invincible militarily is still with them, and yet the fruits necessarily don't show that from wars that have happened since, starting with the Yom Kippur War, which they won but lost severe casualties, and then all the other wars of attrition that have taken place, the two in Lebanon, the number in the Gaza Strip. They haven't come out as resounding victories for Israel. And why is that? Why not God's complete, miraculous deliverance? Of course, God used them. He didn't, you know, wipe out the armies with hornets or something like that. But they did acknowledge that God was helping them after the fact. And yet, it seems that they've forgotten that God did that when looking back on that time today. This thinking that victory was purely a result of Israel's superior military has created a dangerous air of invincibility in Israel. When you start to take credit for things, when that credit belongs to God, you're on dangerous ground. This is when you begin to trust in yourself, your strength, your abilities, rather than in God. Now, Jeremiah the prophet, as many of you know, he told the Jewish state, once before, "Cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm," that looks to flesh for the strength. Now, that's not to say that Israelis aren't some of the most courageous and best fighters in the world. They certainly are. But even that was prophesied by God. If you look back into the book of Genesis chapter 49, the patriarch Jacob, who had his name changed to Israel, he assembled all his sons together at his bedside down in Egypt before he died, and he prophesied to them what would become of their peoples in the end time. And in verse 9 of that chapter, in the New Living Translation, he turns to Judah, Jacob does, and says, "Judah, my son, as a young lion that has finished eating its prey, like a lion he crouches and lies down, like a lioness, who dares to rouse him?" Now we see that lion-like fighting quality in the Jews, even to this day. A lot of the Jews have lost the will to fight, yet a lot of them still have that will to fight. Yet it's not coupled, that will to fight, with faith, belief in God. Or do they seek out God's advice or God's decision-making on when they go to battle, how they fight? Or do they acknowledge God as bringing the victory, if and when it takes place? But we do still see that fighting courage and that spirit in the Jews today. But that was prophesied by God, as we've just covered. Then, over 200 years after that prophecy was given by Jacob, when asking God to bestow blessings upon individual tribes, Moses said, just before they went into the promised land of Judah, in Deuteronomy chapter 33, he says to God, or he asks God, "Hear, O Lord, the voice of Judah, and bring him in to his people. With your hands contend for him, and be a help against his adversaries." Now you look through the blessings that were bestowed on the other tribes, and it isn't like this. God says for Judah, or Moses asks of God for Judah, "Let your hands contend for him. Help him. Help him against his adversaries. Help him. He's going to need help in this end time." Just like in the Six-Day War, when Judah finally becomes a nation, it's going to need help. Now the Jews need to realize that it was not their expertise that safeguarded their future in 1967, that safeguards their future, that help only comes from God. This is what Trumpet editor Gerald Flurry wrote in the booklet Jerusalem in Prophecy, and you can definitely get the copy of this, request it. You can read it online at thetrumpet.com. It's a wonderful book that would really help you see the prophetic events that are going to take place in the future. It helps plot out the prophetic timeline for events concerning Jerusalem, Judah, and even America and Britain as well, and the end time events that we look for to take place regarding this nation. So you can read that, Jerusalem in Prophecy, on thetrumpet.com, or request a hard copy there. But just one line I want to draw out of that book. He said, Mr. Gerald Flurry wrote, "The Jewish nation was born and sustained by godly miracles. But today it still refuses to trust God." And that's what we see. And just looking back on Jerusalem Day this past Sunday, and there's articles coming out about the Six-Day War and how great Israel's military was and how it was a resounding victory that nobody could have predicted. How many of those articles are going to acknowledge that God did it? That the Jewish nation from the very beginning was born and sustained by godly miracles? How many people will acknowledge that fact? How many Jews will acknowledge that fact? Now, when we come back after the break, we're going to look into the Bible and find a man in a remarkably similar situation to the Jewish nation today, and how he put his trust in God to protect and defend the nation, but also how he did his part as well. So grab your Bibles if you'd like to read along, and we'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio show. Again, I'm Brent Nuchtigal, filling in for Stephen Flurry. Now, before the break, we were talking about the Six-Day War and how many at the time of the war's conclusion gave God credit for his intervention in that victory. And yet now, it seems, it's become unfashionable to acknowledge God's help in that. And that's led Israel down a dangerous path of believing that its military is invulnerable, of putting trust in its military. Now, while I will say that Israel does have some strong leadership, which does seem to be lacking in other Western countries, and that the current leadership as well does put the safety of its people first, and how that is commendable, we have to ask, where is God in Israel, the nation today's decision-making? The Jews have a history with God different to anyone else. And yet, how much does God play into their decision-making, into their rationale for the actions that they take? Now, looking back at some of this Jewish history, we're going to see a leader who combined both military genius, foresight, courage, good planning, all those things that we do see even in a lot of Israel's leadership today, but he combined that with trust in God, in bringing God into the fight, in allowing God to fight their battles. Now, the scene of the story, or the history really that I want to cover today, does start out in Susa, in the capital of the Persian Empire. And the year is 445. Judah and Israel, they had already gone into captivity hundreds of years before this, or Israel hundreds of years, and Judah just over 100 years before this. And a group of Jews had already returned under the leadership of Zerubbabel some about 100 years before this point. They had returned back to Jerusalem. And then another group later, about 60 years later, returned with Ezra, 60 or 70 years later. And now, about a decade after Ezra, Jerusalem was in trouble. And in this year, 445, Artaxerxes was the king of Persia. He had just started his 20th year on the throne. And he had a servant, a cupbearer, named Nehemiah. Now, this cupbearer was more than just a taste tester for the king, but rather he was the head of the personal security detail for Artaxerxes. Again, Persian Empire at this time, one of the largest empires on the earth at that time. And he had to make sure, Artaxerxes did, that his cupbearer or his security detail could be one, or the leader of that could be one of the most trusted men in the empire. He had to make sure that he wouldn't fall for bribes or extortion from enemies of the Persian leader, many times coming from their own royal family. So really, he had to be closer and more trusted than even Artaxerxes' other family members. Now, of course, Nehemiah was also a Jew. Now, when his book opens up, he is in Persia, and his brother Hanani has just come to him and described to him the horrible situation Jerusalem finds itself in. Terrorists from the provinces north of Judea, or Yehud as it's called at the time, south of that province, east of that province, they had begun to destroy Jerusalem's defenses. Guerrilla-style type warfare to try and weaken Jerusalem, to try and weaken the Jews. And immediately, Nehemiah, knowing that he's half a world away and unable to act to help the Jews at the time. Instantly, he took the situation to God in prayer and fasting. Now, this is real leadership. Now, you might not think that is real leadership, or Israelis today might not think that that is real leadership, to come across a problem and instantly take it to God to try and get his solution, and to ask God for the solution, and to ask forgiveness, because obviously the situation has come about in Israel's case because of sin. And that's what Nehemiah did. He took it immediately to God. This is real leadership. And the first chapter of the book of Nehemiah details this prayer. But notice the very last verse of Nehemiah chapter 1. This is the very conclusion of his prayer, if you have your Bibles. Nehemiah says, "O Lord, I beseech you, let now your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servants," speaking about himself, "and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name and prosper. I pray you, your servant," that is me, Nehemiah, "this day, and grant him," me again, "mercy in the sight of this man," which is referring to Artaxerxes. Now, notice this is very interesting that Nehemiah recognizes through this prayer that it's only by God's help and God's assistance that the Jews are going to find a way out of this situation. Yet Nehemiah asks for help, that God would grant him mercy, because Nehemiah personally wants to help out in this situation. He wants him to have favor before Artaxerxes so that he can go and attend to this situation. No, he's not going to go to Jerusalem and fight back all these armies himself. He's going to do it with God's help. But he wants to do the work as well. He wants to be the one that can use God's power and use God's help and motivate God's people back there to build the defenses to protect the city. Let's notice chapter 2 now. Chapter 2 and verse 1, we'll read the first four verses. And it says, "And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not before time been sad in his presence. Wherefore the king said unto me, Why is your countenance sad, Nehemiah, seeing that you were not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then I was sore afraid." So Nehemiah has this prayer and fasting for a number of days. He's mourning for Jerusalem. He prays that God will help him. He prays that God will grant him favor in the sight and mercy in the sight of the king of the world. And yet he can't contain his sorrow for Jerusalem when he comes before the king, and it interferes slightly in his duties. And yet Artaxerxes says, "Hey, you've never had a sad face in every single day that you've been working for me. Why are you so upset?" And he was afraid, Nehemiah was, that this might turned out badly for him in front of the king to be acting this way. But Nehemiah was honest and bold, and he responded what was on his mind. Verse 3, exactly what was on his mind. "And he said unto the king, Let the king live forever." So he's got the right respect here. But then says, "Why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, that is Jerusalem, lies waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? Why shouldn't I be sad? Jerusalem, it's being destroyed. The Jews got to return, and yet they're suffering." Then notice verse 4, "Then the king said unto me, For what do you make request?" What do you want then, Nehemiah? And you can think of Nehemiah being completely stunned at this point. Oh, wow, I've still got my head. Even after this somewhat of an emotional response. But notice what he does. Again, the leadership in Israel, all of us listening, me, can take advice from this or instruction from this. What happens when you're put in a situation where you don't exactly know how that you can help the situation, but you know it needs help? What did he do? He said, "So I prayed to the God of heaven." This wasn't a run to his room prayer. This wasn't a prayer where he had time to think it over and pray exactly what God wanted. There and then, instantly, silently, he prayed to God in heaven for help, to know what the request should be. Verse 5, "And I said unto the king," there still before the king and his wife, "If it please the king, And if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you would send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. Let me go and work to build up the defenses of this city. Now, you can think about this request before Artaxerxes, let me, your most trusted bodyguard, go to Jerusalem to fix it. Please, can you do without my services for the next 12 years, as he would ask in the next couple of verses? A long time. And yes, you might, he's got to be thinking about himself in a way here, Artaxerxes, and this is going to put his own security at risk while he finds somebody as faithful and trustworthy as Nehemiah was, and yet he allows him to do it. Verse 8 says, he asked to give him everything I need, the wood that I need to build the wall as well. Please help me out in any way that you can. So there are physical things to be done. We need to take that example, that lesson from this example, that Nehemiah just didn't pray that God would protect the nation, that God would fix it. There was planning. He knew when he got there, he needed the materials to build up the wall, to build the defenses, to restore the gates. And, the Israelis, they do that part quite well. They have a great planning structure or a great structure to ensure that Israelis are safe. You look at the stats of the amount of terrorist attacks that Israelis foil. That Israeli forces foil each year, and you'll be shocked by it. There's not a less or more of a calm over the past few months because the Palestinians have stopped trying to attack Israelis. No, that's because the Israeli services, the agencies, are so effective at foiling the attacks. But where do you see them seeking God's will in their planning? Now, Nehemiah, again, didn't just pray that God would fix the situation. He prayed that he could be used by God to go and fix the situation. And the king Artaxerxes allowed him to go. Now, when he arrived in Jerusalem, shortly thereafter, Nehemiah spent the first few nights going out to survey the physical destruction and the work that needs to be done. He plans out how the wall can be built fast using all the human resources that he has at his disposal. And then he finally reveals himself and his purpose to the people there in Jerusalem. And this is chapter 2 in verse 17. This is Nehemiah now in Jerusalem. He said unto them, "You see the distress that we're in? How Jerusalem lies waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire? Come, and let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach to all these nations. Let us build up the wall." Then notice what he does in verse 18. So that's the physical part. We need to build this. That's what we need to do to protect ourselves. Verse 18, "Then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also the king's words that he had spoken unto me." So he used his example of how God was obviously behind his effort to be there to encourage the people. Look, God has been with me to this point. God wants us to do this. He is behind this work. And then look how that motivated the people. And they said, not Nehemiah now, the people, "Let us rise up and build." So they strengthened their hands for this good work. So they started to work on the wall, the famous wall that only takes 52 days to construct. And the people, they obviously built the wall. They weren't just sitting back and praying that the wall appeared. They built the wall, but they sought God's guidance through it all and acknowledged that God helped them do it even at the end, as we'll see. Now, verse 19 is part of the interesting part of this account because it details the enemies of Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah, you can think of in the province of Judah or Yehud, which was mainly where the tribes of Judah and Benjamin were anciently when they took the promised land. But they didn't have the rest of the territory up in Israel proper, or Samaria, where Ephraim and Manasseh were, and they didn't have the territory on the other side of the Jordan River, and they didn't have the territory south neither. They only had a small province, yet they were surrounded by enemies. Surrounded, like Israel is today, surrounded. Just north in Samaria, the governor there, Sanballat, he led a cabal of wicked governors that wanted to see Israel's destruction. They wanted to see Israel, or Judah, I should say, or Yehud, wiped off the map. And, you know, they were completely surrounded to the east again by Geshem. Well, Geshem was in the south. He was the governor of Arabia down there. And Tobiah was the governor over the Ammonites, just to the east of them across the Jordan River. So they were surrounded. But nevertheless, with this encouragement from Nehemiah that God was with them, they started building. They organized themselves, or Nehemiah organized themselves into families to build separate portions of the wall. This way the wall could all go up at once rather than just starting in one point and going around the city. They each started, each of these different families, and chapter 3 talks about that, the different families that repaired different parts of this wall. Also, while they were building, half the people were to carry swords and different weapons, and the other half were to continue building in these shifts. They didn't even take off their work clothes, save for the occasional bath. But this construction process, even though it was going fast on and was building, well, this wall was going up extremely fast, that didn't stop the ridicule from all these nations around them. They faced incredible ridicule, but almost to the point of fighting them, or at least them coming against them with their armies, as we'll see. Let's go to chapter 4 now. And again, remember these chapters, the first 6 chapters in Nehemiah take place, or at least from chapter 2 onwards, in this 52-day period. Notice this, chapter 4 and verse 1. But it came to pass that when Sanballat, that is the governor of Samaria, who had an equal rank in the eyes of the Persian Empire that Nehemiah did. Nehemiah was the civil ruler, the governor of Yehud. So this pretty high fellow up in the north, Sanballat, the governor there, heard that we build the wall and was wroth. He was angry and he took great indignation and he mocked the Jews and he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, "What do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in one day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of the rubbish which are burned?" And even his friends got on board. Tobiah the Ammonite to the east was by him at this point, and he said, "Even that which they build, a fox will go up, and he shall even break down their stone wall." Now, I think it's really interesting when you look at this ridicule, because that was the approach of the Arab states early on about the Jews. Pre-1967, the Arab armies were very confident. Pre-1948, the Arab armies were very confident that they could wipe out the Jews, that they could stop this Jewish state from becoming a state early on. And that's what they turn to here as well, ridicule. And they'll send their armies soon enough. But notice Nehemiah's response to this ridicule. He goes straight to prayer again. He says, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised," this is verse 4, "and turn their reproach upon their head, and give them for a prey in the land of their captivity. Cover not their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders." And then the prayer ends, and he says, "So built we the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto the half thereof, for the people had a mind to work." So while this ridicule was tough, they just kept on building. And he asked God for help throughout the process. But there would be other obstacles that would come as well. Let's read on verse 7. "But it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites," so we're introduced to a fourth villain people as well, these Ashdodites, and you can guess where they're from. They're from the Philistine plain, the Gaza Strip area of today. "They heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped. And they were very angry," in verse 8, "conspired all of them together to come, and fight against Jerusalem and hinder it." Now, again, this isn't just four guys talking. These are four leaders of four peoples completely surrounding the Jews. And they were going to come against Jerusalem with their armies. Now, this looks like a dire situation, not one far different from what the Jews are facing today. Did Nehemiah, build up his defenses? Yes, he did. But did he know that without God they had no hope of success? He also understood that truth completely. Look at this, verse 9. Nevertheless, even though there were these armies round about, we made our prayer unto God. So he prayed for protection and set a watch against them day and night because of them. Now, this is an important point to make, because a lot of people talking about how Israel just needs to trust in God and that's it, or pray to God and that's it. Well, that's not all it. There was a work to be done as well. Now, Israel and Judah today, they have the doing part, in the sense of they build a security wall. They go out of their way to try and find these attackers before they act. And yet, where is God? Where is their taking it to God, making their prayer unto God? That doesn't exist in Israel today. Now let's look how God helps. Look how God helped out the Jews back then. Verse 10, and Judah said, after this prayer, remember, after this prayer where Nehemiah says that they prayed unto God for help and they set their watch against them day and night, the people of the Jews said to Nehemiah, the strength of the bearers of burdens is decayed, and there is much rubbish, so that we are not able to build this wall. So partway through, the Jews were getting discouraged. Verse 11, and our adversaries said, they shall not know, neither see, till we come in the midst among them and slay them and cause the work to cease. So they were plotting these attacks. They were plotting attacks to stop the wall from ceasing, the building of the wall from going up. They were trying to cause the work to cease. Verse 12, and it came to pass that when the Jews which dwelt by them came, they said unto us 10 times or repeatedly, from all the places whence you shall return unto us, they will be upon you. So what you had here with this situation where they were planning, all the Samaritans and these different adversaries were planning to come in amongst the Jews and attack them while they were constructing the wall. And yet the Jewish informants around them told Nehemiah of the plan. Verse 13, therefore set I in the lower places behind the wall and on the higher places. I even set the people after their families with swords, with their spears and their bows. So he prepared them for the oncoming attack. Verse 14, and I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles and the rulers and to the rest of the people, be not you afraid of them. Remember the Lord. Remember the Lord. Now, where is somebody that would do that today? After they hear about a potential attack and they set their people in array where that attack might be taking place, where is the first word out of the, or first phrase out of the leader's mouth? Remember the Lord. Be not afraid of them. Remember God, he's on our side, which is great and terrible. And fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Verse 15, and it came to pass, when our enemies heard that it was known unto us, and that God, had brought their counsel to nothing. So wouldn't it be good if you're in the intelligence service of Israel today, and you had God as your intelligence source? And he was using people to come to you because you prayed to God, as you can see in verse 9, for his help. And those people would come to you and tell where all of these things were going to take place. And you could ensure they didn't happen. That would be wonderful, right? We'll just read the completion of verse 15. And it came to pass, I'll read the whole thing. When the enemies heard that it was known unto us and God had brought their counsel to nothing, that we returned all of us to the wall, everyone unto his work. God blessed their intelligence because, again, they look to him. They look to him completely for help. Let's go over to chapter 6 now. And this is the chapter which talks about the completion of the wall. It's a wonderful chapter. This is partway through the plans of the governors and the peoples around Yehud were coming to nothing. So what did they realize, the wall's probably going to go up. So what did they do? Chapter 6 and verse 1. Now it came to pass, when Sanballat, again the same adversaries, and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian, and the rest of our enemies now, heard that I had built the wall, and that there was no breach left therein, except at that time I hadn't set up the doors of the gates. So he's saying there was still some work to do. That Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, "Come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono." But they thought to do me mischief. Now it's interesting that they wanted to have a meeting, some peace talks, in the plain of Ono. The plain of Ono is just north of where the Ashdodites are and just west of where the Samaritans were. It didn't really belong to any of the adversaries of Nehemiah. So they were going to choose a nice peaceful location that didn't have, or that wasn't on one of the sides for these talks, these at these plains of Ono. But notice Nehemiah's response, "And I sent messages unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you? Yet they sent unto me four times after this sort, 'Come down, come down, let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. Yes, we tried to destroy you, but let's talk about it now. We can accept maybe you there. We'll see, let's talk about it.' But Nehemiah said, 'No.' And then the fifth time he sends a letter, this Sanballat character, he tries to blackmail Nehemiah with a letter that he was going to send off to the Persian governor to say that he's building up the defenses of Jerusalem to rebel against the Persians, which this was obviously false, was made up, was feigned out of the imagination of his own heart. And Nehemiah refused to come down to try and meet them. And verse 9 talks about that. Verse 9 says, and this is chapter 6, "For they all made us afraid, saying, Their hand shall be weakened from the work, that it be not done. Then Nehemiah says, Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands." Sure, the people were human. The people looked at the adversaries all around them and knew it was a dangerous situation. But God, he asked God to strengthen his hands. He knew the strength of his arm, the flesh, couldn't provide the protection that they needed. And he asked God to provide it. And he did. Look at verse 15 now. In conclusion, it says, "So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul, in 52 days. Didn't take long. But notice verse 16 as well. "And it came to pass that when all our enemies heard thereof, that the wall was finished, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were very much cast down in their own eyes." Why? "For they perceived that this work was wrought of our God." Even the Gentiles looked at the 52-day construction of this wall while they were trying to destroy them. And they said, "Wow, there must be something different about them. There must be some supernatural intervention. There must be God or a being behind that work." Even the Gentiles could see that, even those heathen nations around. And wasn't that the case after the Six-Day War? When they looked at the size of the armies, the personnel, the materiel of all those Arab armies versus the Jewish state, the small Jewish state. And then they look at what happened after 6 days, just 6 days. And they could tell that that was a work wrought by God. The Israelis could tell that was a work wrought by God as well. This is how a German journalist summarized the Six-Day War. "Nothing like this has happened in history. A force including 1,000 tanks, hundreds of artillery cannons, many rockets and fighter jets, and 100,000 soldiers armed from head to toe was destroyed in 2 days, in an area covering hundreds of kilometers, filled with reinforced outposts and installations. And this victory was carried out by this smaller force." Then the German journalist says, "No military logic or natural cause can explain this monumental occurrence." God was alive to a German journalist just looking at the facts. As he was alive in a similar sense to Sanballat and Geshem and the other enemies, when they saw the work of 52 days of this wall go up, God was alive to the Israelis, many of them, after the Six-Day War. And yet, looking back now, many praise the Israelis' fighting spirit, which, you know, is worthy of praise. But did that win the war? Did it win the war? Israel, sadly, today, has forgotten that God is the one that brings the victory. Sure, you might need to do some work as well. You might need to protect yourself. You might need to build a wall or something. But if you look to God, he'll bring the victories. And you know what? You read the book of Nehemiah front to end. There's no reference of them actually fighting anywhere. None. They prepared themselves to do it. They prayed to God for deliverance. They had the intelligence from God. And yet they didn't even have to fight. God looked after them. Wow. What a stunning example for the Jewish state even today. If you want to read more about what's happening in Judah today and what we expect to happen going forward, we don't expect, sadly, a turnaround yet of the Jewish state in acknowledging God's help in their past and accepting and asking for God's help in their future. But it will happen. It will happen eventually. Please request, once again, Jerusalem Prophecy, that book written by Gerald Flory, to see where the Jews will turn instead of God, sadly, in the upcoming years. You've been listening today to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Today that's coming from Jerusalem, Israel, this Friday. Have a wonderful weekend. And as they say here in Jerusalem, when a holy day approaches, Chag Sameach.